harshness. They would have to learn swiftly enough to face the escalating hardships. He and his friend could teach them, if they would listen. Liat took his seat beside Stilgar and spoke to Var's men with genuine enthusiasm.
Right now, Kelso's air still contains enough moisture that truly dramatic measures aren't required. Soon, though, you will need to be careful not to waste so much as a thimbleful of water.
We already live under the strictest conservation, one man said, as if Liat had insulted him.
Oh? You don't recycle your sweat, respiration, or urine. You still import water from the higher latitudes, where it is readily available. Many regions on Kelso are still able to grow crops, and people live a fairly normal life.
It will get worse, Stilgar agreed. Your people have much hardening to do before the planet reaches its new equilibrium. This is the first day of your new field training. The men muttered uncertainly at hearing such words from two seeming boys, but Liat sounded optimistic.
It is not so bad. We can teach you how to make steel suits, how to conserve every breath, every sweat droplet. Your fighting instincts are admirable, but useless against sandworms. You must learn to survive among the behemoths that will eventually take control of your world. It is a necessary shift in attitude. The Fremen did so for a long time.
Stilgar seated himself beside his friend. It was an honorable way of life. The fighters held on to straps and spread their feet for balance, preparing for takeoff. That is what lies in store for us. Drinking recycled sweat and piss, living in sealed chambers. Only if we fail, old Var said. I choose to believe we still have a chance, no matter how naive that sounds. He closed the ship's hatch and strapped himself into the creaking pilot seat. So, if that doesn't sound pleasant to you, then we'd better stop the desert from gaining more of a foothold. The flyer lifted from the dry camp and swung out over the ghost forests and hummocks of fresh dunes that were swallowing the remnants of grasslands. The engine sputtered periodically as they flew southeast to a region where sandworms had been sighted. The craft seemed like a sluggish bumblebee, its tanks overloaded and heavy. We will stop the moving sands, one young commando said.
Next, you will try to stop the wind.
Stilgar grabbed a dangling strap as a thermal updraft shook the craft.
In a few short years, your planet will be sand and rock. Do you expect a miracle to turn the desert back?
We'll create that miracle for ourselves, Var answered, and his team murmured in agreement. They flew across the wilderness of dunes, far past the point where they could see anything but buttery tan from horizon to horizon. Stilgar tapped a finger against the scratched window plaz and shouted against the engine noise.
See the desert for what it is. Not a place to fear and loathe, but a great engine to power an empire.
Liat added, Already, small worms in the desert belt have created priceless amounts of melange, just waiting to be mined. How have you survived for so long without spice? We haven't needed spice for 1,500 years. Not since we came to Kelso, Var called from the cockpit. When you do not have a thing, you learn to live without it, or you don't live.
We don't give a damn about spice, one of the commandos said. I'd rather give a damn about trees and crops and fat herds.
Var continued, Our first settlers brought a great deal of spice from far away, and 3 generations fought addiction until the supplies were gone. Then what? We were forced to survive without it, and we have.
Why should we open ourselves to that monstrous dependency again? My people are better off without it.
If used carefully, melange has important qualities, Liet said. Health, life extension, the possibility of prescience. And it's a valuable commodity to sell, should you ever reconnect with Chom and the rest of mankind. As Kelso dries up, you may need off-world supplies for your basic needs.
If anyone survives the outside enemy, Stilgar thought to himself, recalling the ever-present threat of capture by the Shimmering Net. But these people were much more concerned with their own local enemies, fighting the desert, trying to stop the unstoppable. He remembered the great dreams of Pardo Kynes, Liet's father. Pardo had done the calculations and determined that the Fremen could turn Dune into a garden, but only after generations of intense effort. According to the histories, Arrakis had indeed become green and verdant for a time, before the new worms reclaimed it and brought the desert back. The planet seemed unable to achieve a balance. The battered craft flew low, its engines droning. Stilgar wondered if the noise of their passage would attract worms, but as he stared down at the hypnotic oceanic dunes, he saw only a couple of patches of rust-colored sand that indicated fresh spice blows. Dropping signal vibrators, Var called, while throbbing canisters, the equivalent of ancient thumpers, tumbled out of the small bays below the cockpit. That should bring at least one of them. With a puff of sand and dust, the thumpers plunged into the dunes and sent out droning signals. After circling back to make certain the devices were operating properly, Var selected two more spots within a radius of 5 kilometers. Stilgar could not determine why the craft still felt overloaded. As they cruised in search of a worm, Stilgar described his legendary days on Dune, how he and Paul Muad'Dib had led a ragtag Fremen army to victory against far superior forces.
We used desert power. That is what you can learn from us. Once you see we are not your enemies, we can learn much from each other.
Under Stilgar's firm hand, these people could come to understand their possibilities. With the awakening of the populace would come the awakening of the planet, with plantings and green zones to keep the desert under control. Perhaps they could succeed if they could just find and maintain an equilibrium. Stilgar remembered something Liet's father had said to him once. Extremes invariably lead to disaster. Only through balance can we fully harvest the fruits of nature. He leaned closer to the craft's observation windows and saw a familiar wrinkling of the sand, ripples of deep movement disturbing the smooth dunes.
Worm sign.
Prepare for our first encounter of the day. A grin wrinkled Var's grizzled face as he turned away from the cockpit. The shipment that came in last night brought us enough water for 2 targets. But we need to find them.
Water?
The heavy ship was carrying water. The men shifted position, heading toward gunnery hatches and hoses mounted on the sides of the stripped-down flyer. The pilot banked back toward the first cluster of thumpers. As the commandos prepared to strike, Stilgar mused about the strange turnabout. Pardo Kynes had spoken of the need to understand ecological consequences, that humans were stewards of the land and never owners. We must do a thing on Arrakis never before attempted for an entire planet. We must use man as a constructive ecological force, inserting adapted terraform life. A plant here, an animal there, a man in that place, to transform the water cycle, to build a new kind of landscape. The battle today was the opposite. Stilgar and Liat would help fight to prevent the desert from swallowing all of Kelso. Through the nearest window, Stilgar saw a mound in motion, a bucking sandworm drawn toward the thumper. Liat crowded close beside him and said, "I estimate it at 40 meters. Larger than Shiana's worms in our hold."
"These have grown in the open desert," Stilgar said. "Shai Hulud wants this planet."
"Not if I can help it," Var said. But as if to defy him, directly below the flyer, an immense head surfaced and quested around, trying to track the conflicting sources of vibrations. Long tubes protruded from the front and rear of the flyer. The commandos gripped their gun mountings, nozzles that could be turned and aimed. The flyer swooped low. "Fire when ready, but conserve what you can. The water's deadly enough." The fighters shot high-pressure streams from their hoses, blasting the sandworm below. The drenching bursts were more effective than artillery shells. Taken by surprise, the creature writhed and twisted its round head back and forth, convulsing. Hard ring segments split apart to reveal softer pink flesh between, and water burned like acid into the vulnerable parts. The worm rolled on the wet sand in obvious agony.
"They are killing Shai Hulud," Stilgar said, sickened.
Liat was also stunned, but said, "These people have to defend themselves."
"That's enough. It is dead. Or soon will be," Var shouted.
The small force reluctantly shut off their hoses, looking with hatred upon the dying worm. Unable to dig deep enough to escape the poisonous moisture, the mortally wounded creature continued to squirm as the flyer circled over its death throes. Finally, the beast gave a great final shudder and stopped moving. Stilgar nodded, his expression still grim.
"There are necessities to life in the desert, hard decisions to be made."
He had to accept the clear fact that this worm did not belong here on Kelso. No sandworm did. On the way back to the settlement, they encountered a second worm, drawn by the vibrations of their flyer's engines. The commandos emptied their water reservoirs, and the second worm perished even more quickly. Liat and Stilgar sat together in uncomfortable silence, wrapped up in what they had seen and the fight they had agreed to join.
"Even though she doesn't have her memories back yet," Liat said, "I'm glad my daughter Chaney did not see this."
Though the mood of the fighters was upbeat aboard the flyer, the two young men, remembering Arrakis, murmured Fremen prayers. Stilgar was still contemplating what they had seen and done when Var yelled a strangled-sounding alarm. Suddenly, strange ships swarmed around them.
"You see only harshness, devastation, and ugliness.
That is because you have no faith. Around me I see a potential paradise, for Arrakis is the birthplace of my beloved prophet." Waff of the Tleilaxu. When he first glimpsed Arrakis, the bleak ruins brought dismay to Waff's heart. But when Edric's Highliner deposited him and his small team of guild assistants there, he experienced the joy of setting foot on the desert planet again. He could feel the holy calling deep inside his bones. In his previous lifetime, he had stood on these sands, face to face with the Prophet. With Shiana and Reverend Mother Odraed, he had ridden a great worm out to the ruins of Siege Tabur. His Gola memories were corrupted and uncertain, riddled with annoying gaps. Waff could not recall his final moments as the Horrors closed in around the desert planet, deploying their awful obliterators. Had he run for hopeless shelter, looking behind him like Lot's wife for a last glimpse of the doomed city? Had he seen explosions and walls of flame searing the sky, sweeping toward him?
But the cells of another Waff Gola had been grown in an axolotl tank in Bandalung as part of the usual process. The secret council of the Kale had planned for the serial immortality of all Tliloxu masters long before anyone had heard of honored Matres. The next thing he knew, Waff was awakened to his past life during a Grand Guignol stage show as the brutal women murdered one of his twins after another until just one of them, him, reached a sufficiently desperate crisis to break through the Gola barrier and reveal his past. Some of it, at least. But not until now had Waff actually seen the Armageddon that the horrors had wrought on this sacred world. The ecosystem of Rakkas had been fundamentally destroyed. Half of the atmosphere was burned away, the ground sterilized, most life forms dead, from the microscopic sand plankton all the way up to the giant sandworms. It made the old dune seem comfortable by comparison. The sky was a dark purple, touched with an underburn of orange. As their ship circled, searching for a spot less hellish than others, Waff studied a panel of atmospheric readings. The moisture content was abnormally high. At some point in its geologic history, Arrakis had possessed open water, but sand trout had sealed it all away. During the bombardment, underground rivers and seas must have been vaporized as they were released from aquifers. The honored Matre's horrific weapons had not only turned the soft dunes to a baked moonscape, they had also thrown up great clouds of dust that had not settled entirely out of the atmosphere, even decades later. The Coriolis storms would be worse than ever before. He and his team would likely have to wear special bodily protection and supplemental breather masks. Their small dwelling huts would need to be sealed and pressurized. Waff didn't mind. Was that so different from wearing a stillsuit? By degrees, perhaps, but not fundamentally harder. His lighter circled over the remains of a sprawling metropolis that had been called Arrakeen in the days of Muad'Dib, then the festival city of On during the reign of the god emperor, and later, after Leto II's death, the moated city of Keen. No longer concerned about secrecy, now that the sea worms had successfully taken hold on Boozle, Waff was happy to have four assistants help him with the hard work he was sure to face on this obliterator-blasted planet. Studying the surface, he discerned lumpy geometric shapes that had once been angled streets and tall buildings. Surprisingly, in the dimness of seared daylight, he also spotted numerous artificial illumination sources and a few dark structures of recent construction. There seems to be a camp down there. Who else would come to Rakkas? What could they possibly want here? The same as us, said the guildsman. Spice. He shook his head. Too little here anymore. At least until we bring back the worms. No one else has that skill. Pilgrims, perhaps. There may still be those who make a hajj, a second assistant said. Waff knew that a dizzying mishmash of religious splinter groups and cults had sprung from Rakkas. More likely, suggested a third guildsman, they are treasure hunters. Waff quoted quietly from the cant of the Shariat. When greed and desperation are coupled, men accomplish superhuman feats, though for the wrong reasons. He considered choosing a different place for their base camp, then accepted the idea that joining resources with the strangers might help them all last longer in the harsh environment. No one knew when or if Edric might be coming back for them, or how long the sandworm work would take, or how much longer Waff himself would last. He planned to be here for the remainder of his days. After the lighter landed unannounced at the edge of the camp, the guildsmen waited for instructions from Waff. The Tliloxu man settled goggles over his eyes to protect against the caustic wind and emerged.
For long journeys outside, he might have to wear a supplemental oxygen mask, but the Rakian atmosphere was surprisingly breathable. 6 tall and dirty men faced him from the encampment. They wore rags wrapped around their heads, carried knives and antique Mala pistols. Their eyes were red-veined, their skin rough and cracked. The foremost man had shaggy black hair, a square chest, and a rock-hard potbelly.
"You are fortunate that I'm curious about why you are here. Otherwise, we would have shot you out of the sky."
Waff held up his hands. "We are no threat to you, whoever you are." 5 men leveled their Mala pistols, and the other slashed the air with his knife. "We have claimed Rakkus for ourselves. All spice here is ours."
"You've claimed a whole planet?"
"Yes, the whole damned planet." The first man tossed back his dark hair.
"I'm Gurev, and these are my prospectors. There's damned little spice left in the burned crust, and it's ours."
"Then you may have it." Waff performed a perfunctory bow. "We have other interests, as geological investigators and archaeologists. We wish to take readings and run tests to determine the extent of damage to the ecosystem." The 4 guild assistants waited beside him in complete silence. Gurev laughed loudly and heartily.
"There isn't much of an ecosystem left here."
"Then where does breathable oxygen come from?" He knew that Liet Kynes had asked that question in the ancient days, curious because the planet had neither widespread plant life nor volcanoes to generate an atmosphere. The man just stared. Obviously, he had not thought about this.
"Do I look like a planetologist to you?"
"Go ahead and look into it, but don't expect any help from us. Here on Rakkus, you are self-sufficient or you die." The Tliloxu man raised his eyebrows. "And what if we wish to share some of our spice coffee with you, as a token of friendship? I understand that water is more easily obtainable than in the old days."
Gurev glanced at his prospectors, then said, "We're happy to accept your hospitality, but we have no intention of reciprocating.
Nonetheless, our offer stands." Inside Gurev's dusty hut, Waff used his own supplies of melange, left over from his sandworm experiments, to brew coffee. Gurev didn't have a desperate shortage of water in his camp, though his dwelling smelled of long unwashed bodies and the savory sweetness of a drug smoke that Waff could not identify. At his command, the 4 guildsmen erected the shelters brought down from the Highliner, setting up armored sleeping tents and laboratory enclosures. Waff saw no reason to assist them. He was a Tliloxu master, after all, and these were his workers, so he would allow them to perform their tasks. While they drank a second pot of spice coffee, Gurev grew more relaxed. He didn't trust the diminutive Tliloxu, but he didn't seem to trust anyone. He took pains to say he harbored no particular hatred toward Waff's race, and that his scavengers held no grudges against others of low social position. Gurev cared only about Rakkus.
"All that melted sand and plascrete. By chipping away the upper crust of glass, we were able to get down to the foundations of the sturdier buildings in Keen."
Gurev produced a hand-drawn chart.
"Scraping out buried treasure. We found what we think is the original Bene Gesserit keep. A few heavily barricaded bomb shelters filled with skeletons."
He smiled.
"We also uncovered the extravagant temple built by the priests of the divided god. It was so huge we couldn't miss it. Full of trinkets, but still not enough to pay for our effort."
Chome is expecting us to find something much more extraordinary, though they seem happy enough to sell containers of genuine Rakian sand to gullible fools. Waff didn't reply. Edric and the navigators had obtained such Rakian sand for him to use in his original experiments. But we've got a lot more digging to do. Keen was a big city. In his previous life, Waff had seen those structures before they were destroyed. He knew the ostentation that the deluded priests placed in all the rooms and towers, as if God cared about such gaudiness. Gurif and his men would indeed find plenty of treasure there, but the wrong kind. The priesthood's temple had collapsed worse than most other large buildings. Maybe it was a direct target of the honored Matre attack. The prospector smiled with thick lips. But deep in the sublevels beneath the temple, we did find chests of stored Solaris and hoarded melange. A worthwhile haul. More than we expected, but not so much. We're after something bigger. The tyrant buried a huge spice hoard deep in the southern polar regions. I'm sure of it. Waff made a skeptical sound as he sipped spice coffee. No one has been able to find that treasure for 1,500 years. Gurif held up a finger, noticed a hangnail, and chewed on it. Still, the bombardment may have churned up the crust enough to reveal the motherlode. And thanks be to the gods, there are no worms left to torment us. Waff made a non-committal sound. Not yet. Without bothering to sleep, knowing his time was short, the Tliloxu man began to make preparations to continue his work. His guild companions seemed confident that the navigator would eventually return, though Waff wasn't so sure. He was here on Rakkis, and this gave him great pleasure. While the guild assistants finished connecting the generators and sealed the prefab shelters, the Tliloxu researcher went back aboard the near-empty lighter. In the cargo hold, he smiled paternally at his magnificent specimens. The armored worms were small but ferocious. They looked ready to tackle a dead world. Their world. Ages ago, the Fremen had been able to summon and ride sandworms, but those original creatures had died out when Leto II's terraforming operations had turned Arrakis into a garden world with green plants, flowing rivers, and moisture from the sky. Such an environment was fatal to sandworms. But when the God Emperor was assassinated and his body fissioned into sand trout, the whole process of desertification began anew. The freshly spawned worms became far more vicious than their predecessors, tackling the huge challenge of recreating the dune that once was. Waff now faced a challenge many times more difficult. His modified creatures were armored to resist the most severe environment, with mouths and head ridges powerful enough to crack through the vitrified dunes. They could dig deep beneath the black surface. They could grow and reproduce, even here. He stood before the dusty holding tank in which the worms churned. Each specimen was about 2 meters in length and strong. Sensing his presence, the creatures twitched restlessly. Waff looked outside to where the sky had turned the deep purple-brown of dusk. Storms swirled gritty dust through the atmosphere. "Be patient, my pets," he said. "Soon I will release you." We are naive to think that we control a precious commodity. Only through guile and eternal wariness do we keep it out of the hands of our competitors. Spacing Guild Internal Report.
Edric moved his highliner away from the ruins of Rakkas, no longer concerned with the Tleilaxu master. Waff had served his purpose. More important, the Oracle of Time had summoned all surviving navigators, and Edric would give them joyous news. With the sea worms obviously thriving on Boozle, there would be plenty of ultra spice for the taking. The unusual concentrated form might even be superior to the original spice. A frighteningly potent melange to keep navigators alive without the meddling, greedy administrator faction or the witches of Chapter House. Freedom. It had amused him to see Waff taking his worm samples to Rakkas, hoping to establish a new spice cycle. Edric didn't think the little researcher could do much there, but an alternative source of melange would be a bonus. But even without that, never again would the navigators be strangled by power games. The four guildsmen whom Edric had sent to accompany Waff were spies, and would secretly report everything the Tleilaxu achieved. Inside his tank, Edric smiled to himself, pleased that he had thought of all eventualities. With the first package of Boozle Ultra Spice safely stored in his security chamber, the navigator guided his highliner out into the emptiness of space. Even the Oracle would congratulate him for this remarkable news. Before he could travel toward his scheduled rendezvous, however, the emptiness rippled around him. When Edric studied the distortions, he realized what they were. Moments later, scores of guild ships appeared like buckshot in space, winking through fold space and emerging forward and back, above and below, to surround his highliner completely. Edric transmitted on a band that only fellow navigators should have received. "Explain your presence." But none of the imposing newcomers answered. Studying the glyphs and cartouches on the sides of the enormous hulls, he realized that these were new guild ships, guided by Ixion mathematical compilers. The computer-controlled vessels closed in. Sensing the threat, Edric transmitted with greater alarm, "What is your justification?" The other guild ships formed a smothering blanket around his highliner. The silence of the great vessels was more intimidating than any voiced ultimatum. Their proximity distorted his Holtzman fields, preventing him from folding space. Finally, a voice spoke, flat and dull in timbre, yet unnervingly confident. "We require your cargo of sea worm spice. We will board your ship for inspection." Edric assessed these enemies, his mind racing through a labyrinth of possibilities. The ships appeared to belong to the administrator faction. They functioned with Ixion devices, so they had no need for navigators or melange. Why then would they want to confiscate the Ultra Spice? To prevent navigators from having it? To ensure the guild's complete reliance on Ixion navigation machines? Or could this be another foe entirely? Were these ships flown by Chome pirates hoping to seize a valuable new asset? Witches from Chapter House wanting to force continued dependence on the Sisterhood's melange? But how would any outsiders know about the Ultra Spice? While Edric's highliner hung helpless in space, small interdiction ships emerged from the surrounding guild vessels. He had no choice but to allow boarders onto his ship. Though Edric did not recognize him, a man wearing appropriate guild insignia marched along the decks and ascended to the restricted level, brushing aside all security barriers. Six well-muscled men accompanied him. The leader smiled condescendingly when he stood before the navigator's tank and looked into it. "Your new spice has fascinating possibilities. We require it from you." Edric boomed from within his chamber, intentionally amplifying the speaker system. Go to Boozle and obtain your own. This is not a request, said the man, his face bland. We have learned the intensity of this substance and believe it to be a remedy for our difficult situation. We will take it to the heart of the Thinking Machine Empire.
Thinking machines?
What did the administrator faction have to do with the enemy? You may not have it, Edric repeated, as if he had any say in the matter. The bland-faced guildsman gestured to his burly bodyguards, and they withdrew iron-tipped hammers from their slick gray robes. The leader gave them a calm, matter-of-fact nod. Panicked, Edric swam backward in his tank, but he had nowhere to go. The muscular bodyguards did not care that he was inside the container or that exposure to the air would kill him. With thick arms, they swung their heavy sledges and smashed the thick plaz walls. Jagged cracks split out in starburst patterns, and concentrated orange spice gas whistled out through the breaches. The guards did not react to the melange streaming into their faces, though the concentration should have made a normal human reel. Their bland-faced leader watched like a man smelling an approaching storm while Edric's atmosphere drained out. When the air pressure was no longer sufficient to buoy him, the navigator collapsed to the floor of his tank. Weakly, he raised his webbed hands and demanded answers in a voice that was little more than a gasp. The guildsman and his companions offered no explanations. Withering and twitching, Edric lay on the floor. He extended a rubbery arm and tried to crawl, but with all the spice gas draining away, the air was too thin. He could no longer breathe, could hardly move. Even so, the navigator was slow to die. The bland-faced man stepped closer to the shattered wall, and his features metamorphosed. Crone said to his face dancer companions, "Take the concentrated spice. With this substance, Omnius will awaken his Kwisatz Haderach." The others departed to search the decks and soon uncovered the hoard of modified melange. When the disguised guards returned to the interdiction ships, Crone held one of the heavy packages in his arms. He inhaled deeply. Excellent. Remove all of our people from this highliner. When we are safe, destroy the ship and everyone aboard it. He looked coolly down at the dying Edric. Only a few rusty curls of gas continued to ooze from cracks in the tank. You have served your purpose, Navigator. Take solace in that. The face dancer strutted away. Edric continued to heave great breaths, but barely a scent of melange remained. By the time the computer-controlled guild ships got into formation in space, he could barely keep from slumping into unconsciousness. The opposing vessels opened fire. Edric's highliner exploded before he could utter a curse. There is an art to legend-telling, and an art to living the legend. A saying of ancient Catane. The Ithaca's replenishing operations had taken place in the still rich northern latitudes, far from any visible population centers. Garimi managed the complex process with dozens of flying craft from the hangar decks, leaving Duncan on the command bridge. He felt trapped there, unable to leave because of the protective veil that the no-ship usually afforded him. He hated having to remain behind while others did the risky work, and he didn't even know what the old man and woman wanted from him. He had no idea what was going on back in the old empire, with Mirbella and Chapter House. He knew only that the enemy was still searching for him. And he was still hiding, as he had been for decades. Was this truly the best way to fight?
the best way to defend humanity? He had been adrift for as long as the Ithaca, and of late, the waters of uncertainty seemed deeper than ever. It had been 2 days now without word from Teg or Shiana and their team. If their group was simply meeting with the natives, someone should have checked in by now. Duncan feared another trap like the one they had encountered on the planet of the Handlers. Miles Teg had been his mentor and his student. And Shiana? Ah, Shiana. They had been lovers and sexual opponents. She had cured him and saved him. So, of course, he cared for her. He had tried to protect himself by denying it, but she hadn't believed him, and he hadn't believed himself. Both knew they had a bond unlike any other, different from the one he and Mirbella had imposed upon one another. As he studied the landscape below, it seemed to call to him. Many cities were discernible in the northern and southern forested latitudes. He felt he should be down there facing any possible dangers with the others, not stuck aboard the Ithaca, forced to remain safe and out of sight. How long am I supposed to wait? When he was swordmaster of House Atreides, he would never have hesitated. If it had been young Paul Atreides under threat, Duncan would have leapt in to fight for him, ignoring the intangible threat of the old man and woman. As the witches said in their oft-quoted litany, "I will face my fear." And it was about time he did so. He closed his eyes, not wanting to see the spreading desert that looked like a seeping knife wound across the continent. "I will not ignore this." Duncan summoned Thufir Hawat as well as Garimi, who had recently returned to the no-ship with all of her flying craft after reloading the Ithaca's stores. Duncan stood when they arrived. "We are going to rescue the landing party," he announced, "and we're going to do it now. I don't know what kind of military force those people have down there, but we'll stand against it if the Bashar is in trouble." Thufir's eyes brightened and his face flushed. "I'll pilot one of the ships." Duncan remained stern. "No, you will follow my orders." Garimi was taken aback by Duncan's bold comment, but nodded as she heard him rebuke Thufir. "Do you have instructions for us before we depart? Shall I command the mission?" "No, I will do it personally." Before either could argue with him, Duncan strode toward the lift, and they were forced to follow him. "I'm sick of hiding. My plan has been to run and remain unobtrusive, staying one step ahead of that strange net. But in doing so, I've left too much of myself behind. I am Duncan Idaho." He raised his voice as they entered the lift. "I was swordmaster of House Atreides and consort of St. Aaliyah of the Knife. I acted as advisor and companion to the God Emperor. If the enemy is out there, I won't leave the rest of humanity to face it themselves. If Shiana and the Bashar need my help, then I'm going to help." Thufir stiffened, then allowed himself a pleased smile. "You should have left the Ithaca long ago, Duncan. I don't see what you've accomplished by staying here. The No Field hasn't exactly offered perfect protection." Garimi seemed pleased by Duncan's attitude. "My recovery teams took a good look at that planet down there, and it seems a fine place to settle. Does that mean you'll stop opposing my efforts and let us form a colony at last?" The lift doors closed, and the group began to drop toward the hangar decks where the many ships were being refueled. That remains to be seen. Teg bided his time in the camp long after Stilgar and Liat flew off into the early morning. By now, Duncan would certainly have drawn the obvious conclusions.
"Do you think they'll kill us after all?"
Shiana's tone was surprisingly matter-of-fact, as if she had accepted the inevitable.
Maybe just you. You're the one they blame. He spoke without humor. Though they were allowed to sit on the ground outside, their captors still watched them closely. She sipped from a small cup of water that had been provided.
Is that a joke?
A distraction. Teg glanced up at the sky. We have to trust Duncan to decide on the correct response.
Maybe he thinks we can handle this ourselves. Duncan has great confidence in our independent abilities.
As do I. Should it become necessary, I could slaughter every one of these people. He chose the word intentionally. Slaughter. As he had done with the honored Matres in their fortress on Gamu. And it would take me no longer than the blink of an eye. You know it. Shiana had seen him move against the handlers, helping her, Thufir, and the rabbi escape, and she had also seen how much that brief burst of energy had drained him.
Yes, I know, Miles. And I pray it doesn't become necessary.
Off in the distance, they heard the whining drone of the small flyer returning from the desert. Teg's sharply attuned ears recognized its sputtering engine sound. The villagers gathered at the packed landing zone, anxious to receive the hunting party. First, two specks appeared in the sky, flying low. Then, they were joined by many more dots, like a dispersed flock of migrating birds. The drone grew to a roar. Teg shaded his eyes, identifying many of the flying craft. Mining shuttles and lighters from the no-ship. So this is how Duncan plans to rescue us. He's trying to impress them. It appears he sent everything we have.
We certainly have superior firepower.
Duncan could have taken the direct method and rescued us by force of arms. Watching the ships come closer, Teg smiled. He's smarter than that. Like me, he wants to avoid bloodshed, especially in a conflict he doesn't entirely understand. Did I teach him that lesson? Or did he teach me? As the Bashar reflected on their past lives, he didn't know the answer. More than 40 craft landed together in a flat, open space at the outskirts of the village. They weren't war vessels or armored attack ships, though some had defensive weapons. The Bashar stepped with Shiana away from the tents to face the largest mining shuttle. No one tried to stop them. The people were too awed by what they saw. It surprised Teg to see Duncan Idaho himself march down the ramp of the lead craft, wearing his traditional House Atreides uniform, complete with polished boots and the starburst insignia of his rank. If the Kelsons had been gone from the old empire for 15 centuries, they weren't likely to recognize any of the symbols, but Teg thought the uniform gave his friend a distinguished aura of command, and undoubtedly provided self-assurance. Duncan swept his gaze across the confused villagers, finally spotting Teg and Shiana. The relief on his face was obvious as he made his way to them. You're still alive. And unhurt?
Stuka isn't,
Shiana said with an edge of bitterness. You shouldn't have left the no-ship, Teg said. You're vulnerable now. Visible to the searchers and their wide net. Let them find me. Duncan appeared stony, as if he had reached an inescapable conclusion. This endless chase and hiding accomplishes nothing. I can't defeat the enemy unless I confront them. Shiana glanced nervously at the sky, as if expecting the old man and woman to appear suddenly.
Garimi could have led the attack, or even Thufir. Instead, you let yourself be swayed by your emotions.
I factored them in when I made my correct decision. Duncan's face flushed, as if he were hiding the real answer, and he rushed ahead with an explanation. By comm line, I spoke with Stilgar and Liet Kynes aboard the flyer.
We intercepted them out in the desert, so I have some inkling of what's going on here. I know how they killed Stuka. And why.
And you're surprised to see me alive, Shiana asked. Grateful, too, I hope.
Teg interrupted. The death of Stuka was a tragic overreaction. These people made assumptions about us. Nodding, Duncan said, yes, Miles. And if I had made an overzealous response with superior firepower, that would have caused many more deaths and a much greater tragedy. In one of my earlier lives, I might have done exactly that. But I only needed to think about what you would have done.
Stilgar and Liat emerged with the commandos from the tanker. The two young Golas displayed a hardness to them now, and new life behind their eyes. The Fremen Naib and the planetologist had found something on Kelso that re-energized them and transported them to other times.
Teg understood what all the Golas had gone through since recovering their memories. They had been sheltered and comfortable aboard the Ithaca, forced to content themselves with reading about their pasts and watching the sandworms in the cargo hold as if they were specimens in a zoo. But these Golas could remember the real Arrakis. The lives of Stilgar and Kynes had not been safer or more comfortable in the tumultuous old days, but there had been a certain sharp definition to who they were. Others continued to emerge from the landed vessels. Thufir, Garimi, and more than a dozen sisters, muscular male Bene Gesserit workers, second-generation children born aboard the no-ship, setting foot on a real planet for the very first time in their lives. Five of the rabbi's followers stood in bright sunlight, looking around in wonder at the landscape, at the open spaces. Presently, the old man himself emerged, blinking his bespectacled, owlish eyes. Var looked admiringly at the mining shuttles and lighters, at his new companions, Stilgar and Liat. He raised his chin. Apparently, Duncan had also spoken with the village leader at length during their flight back from the desert.
Duncan, Idaho, you know what trials we face here. What we've been driven to do. We are the only ones who will stand against the death of this planet. We did not bring the desert here. You have no right to condemn us.
I didn't condemn you for your struggle, but I can't condone what you did to our companion. Years ago, Bene Gesserit visitors to your world acted without considering the consequences of what they were doing to you. And now it appears you have done the same thing. The old leader shook his head. His eyes burned with anger and righteousness. We killed the witches responsible for depositing sand trout here. Finding another witch, we killed her too.
Duncan abruptly cut off what was sure to be a pointless argument.
We will take our friends and leave you. I'll let you have your fruitless fight against a desert you can't defeat.
Teg and Shiana stepped forward, anxious to leave this place. Liat and Stilgar, though, held back and looked at each other. The latter squared his shoulders and said,
Duncan, Bashar,
Liat and I are having second thoughts. This is the desert. Not our desert, but closer than anything we have yet encountered as Golas. We were brought back to life for a purpose. The skills from our past lives can be vital resources in a place like this.
Liat Kynes picked up the speech as if he and Stilgar had rehearsed what they were going to say.
Look around. Can you imagine a world where our talents are more desperately needed? We are trained as fighters against impossible odds. We are used to desert combat. As a planetologist, I know the best ways to control the spread of the dunes, and I understand more about the sandworm cycle than most people.
Stilgar added, his passion rising.
we can show these fighters how to build CHs in the harshest desert. We can teach them to make real stillsuits. One day, perhaps, we shall even ride the great worms again.
His voice cracked.
No one can stop the desert, but we can keep the people alive. The rest of you go back to the no-ship, but the Kelsons need us here.
Shiana stopped at the hatch of the nearest ship, clearly displeased.
That is not possible. We need you, and all of the Golas aboard the Ithaca. Each one of you was created, raised, and trained to assist us against the enemy.
But no one knows how, Shiana, Duncan pointed out, moved by what the two young men had said. None of you can say for certain why we need Stilgar and Liat. And what exactly is our fight?
We are not your tools or game pieces.
Stilgar crossed his arms over his chest.
We are human beings with free will, regardless of how we might have been created. I never asked to serve the Bene Gesserit witches.
Liat stood by his friend.
This is what we want to do, and who's to say it isn't our destiny? We could save a planet, or at least its population. Isn't that an important enough goal?
Teg understood the dilemma all too well. These two had found a connection they could hold on to, a battle they could fight that did indeed require their specific abilities. He himself had been created as a pawn, and he'd been forced to play that role. Let them go, Shiana. You have enough experimental subjects on the ship. Thufir Hawat came up to the Bashar, relieved to see his mentor safe. He shot a disturbed glance toward Shiana.
Is that all we are to them, Bashar? Experimental subjects?
In a certain sense. And now we must go back to our cage. He was anxious to leave this dying planet before other problems arose.
Not so fast, the old rabbi said, stepping forward.
My people are not, and never have been, part of your reckless flight across space. We've always wanted a world to settle. Compared to metal decks and small chambers, this planet looks good enough.
Kelso is dying, Shiana said.
The rabbi and his hard-working companions simply shrugged. Var scowled, as did some of the nomadic villagers nearest him. We do not need any further drain on our resources. You are welcome here only if you intend to fight back against the desert. Isaac, one of the strong Jewish men, nodded.
If we decide to stay here, we will fight and work. Our people are no strangers to surviving when the rest of the universe is pitted against us.
No matter where I go, no matter what I leave behind, my past is always with me, like a shadow. Duncan, Idaho. No ship logs. Liat Kynes and Stilgar returned briefly to the Ithaca to retrieve informational archives and some of the equipment they would need to monitor Kelso's changing climate. Liat even converted several spare sensor buoys into orbital weather sats, which the no-ship deployed. He said his goodbyes to the other Gola children who had been raised with him, Paul Atreides, Jessica, Leto II, and Chaney, his own daughter. With a surge of emotion, Liat grasped the hand of the young woman, who was physically almost 3 years older than he. He smiled at her.
Chaney, someday you will remember me as I was on Arrakis. Busy in the CHs, working as the Imperial Planetologist or as a judge of the change, carrying on my father's dream for the Fremen and for Dune.
Her expression was intense, as if she struggled to grasp some faint flicker of memory as she listened to him. Releasing her hand, he touched her forehead, her dark red hair.
"Maybe I was a strong leader, but I'm afraid I wasn't much of a father. So I must tell you, before I go, that I love you. Then, und now, when you remember me, remember all we shared. I will. If I remembered everything now, I'd probably want to go with you back to the desert. And so would Usul."
Beside them, Paul shook his head. "My place is here. Our fight is bigger than one desert." Stilgar took his friend's arm, urging Liat to hurry.
"This planet is large enough for us. I feel in my soul that this is why Liat and I have been brought back, whether or not Shianna realizes it. Perhaps someday, no matter how it appears now, we will all see that this is part of the greater battle."
Meanwhile, the rabbi spoke to his 52 enthusiastic followers at their stations on the no-ship. Isaac and Levi had taken over many of the old man's duties, and at his signal they directed the Jews to gather their possessions and bring prefabricated shelters from the Ithaca's vast storage chambers. Soon, all of them had shuttled down to the surface, where they disembarked and began unloading the landed cargo ships under Isaac's direction. On the ground, Var strode through the activity, marshaling his followers. He ran a covetous eye over several of the craft that Duncan had brought down during his show of force. "Those mining shuttles would be a great help to us for carrying supplies and water across the continent." Shianna shook her head.
"Those ships belong to the Ithaca. We may need them."
Var glowered at her. "Small enough compensation for causing the death of an entire world, I'd say."
"I didn't contribute to the death of your world. You, however, killed Stuka in cold blood before—"
Quickly, Teg went into Mentat mode, mentally inventorying the supplies and equipment they carried aboard the no-ship. To Shianna, he murmured, "Although we had no part in the damage done to this world, we did resupply our ship here, and many of our people are staying behind as settlers.
A token payment is not unreasonable."
When she nodded, Teg turned to Var. "We can spare 2 shuttles. No more."
"And 2 desert experts," Liat piped up. "Stilgar und me."
"Not to mention a willing and hardy workforce. You'll be glad to have the Jews here." Teg had noticed how industrious the rabbi's people were. He expected they would do well on this planet, even as the climate turned harsher. Someday, however, they might decide that Kelso wasn't their promised land after all. Not surprisingly, Garimi and her conservative followers also wanted to leave the no-ship permanently. More than 100 of the sisters asked to be released from the Ithaca to settle on Kelso, even with its ever-growing desert. There, they planned to establish the foundation for their new order. Back on the no-ship, Garimi announced their choice to Shianna more as a courtesy than a matter for discussion. But the people of Kelso would hear none of that. They met the sisters' landed shuttle with drawn weapons. Var stood with his arms crossed over his chest. "We accept Liat Kynes and Stilgar among us, as well as the Jews. But no Bene Gesserit witch is welcome here." "No witches," other Kelsans cried, their expressions suddenly murderous. "If we find them, we kill them." Having accompanied them for a farewell, Shianna tried to speak on Garimi's behalf.
"We could take them to the other side of the continent. You would never know about their settlement. I promise, they'll cause you no trouble.
But the incensed Kelsons were not inclined to listen, and Var spoke again.
Your kind act only for the benefit of the sisterhood. We welcomed them once, to our deep and lasting regret. Now Kelsons act for the benefit of Kelso. No member of your sisterhood is welcome here. Short of violence, I cannot be more clear than that.
Sending up a puff of dust with every step, the rabbi trudged past tents and portable buildings toward the shuttle. He wiped sweat from his brow and came to stand before Teg and Shiana, looking uneasily from one to the other.
I think my people will be happy here, by the grace of God.
He kicked at the dry dirt with his shoe. We were meant to have ground under our feet.
You look disturbed, Rabbi, Shiana noted.
Not disturbed. Sad. To Teg, he appeared crestfallen, and his watery old eyes seemed redder than usual, as if from crying.
I will not be with them. I cannot leave the no-ship.
Black-bearded Isaac draped a consoling arm around the elderly man's shoulders.
This will be the new Israel for us, Rabbi, under my leadership. Won't you reconsider?
Why aren't you staying with your people? Teg asked. The rabbi lowered his gaze, and tears dropped on the hard scrabble ground.
I have a higher obligation to one of my followers whom I failed.
Isaac explained to Shiana and Teg in a soft voice.
He wishes to remain with Rebecca.
Though she is an axolotl tank now, he refuses to leave her. I shall watch over her for all my remaining days. My followers will be in good hands here. Isaac and Levi are their future, while I am their past. The rest of the Jews surrounded the rabbi, saying their goodbyes and wishing him well. Then the weeping old man joined Teg, Shiana, and the others on the waiting shuttle, which took them back up to the no-ship. 24 years after escape from Chapter House.
We are wounded, but undefeated. We are hurt, but can endure great pain. We are driven to the end of our civilization and our history, but we remain human.
Mother Commander Mirbella, address to the survivors of Chapter House. As the epidemic burned itself out, the survivors, all of them reverend mothers, struggled to hold the sisterhood together. No vaccines, immunity treatments, diets, or quarantines had any effect as the general populace died. It required only 3 days for Mirbella's heart to turn to stone. Around her, she watched thousands of promising young acolytes perish, diligent students who had not yet learned enough to become reverend mothers. Every one of them died either from the plague or from the agony that was rushed upon them. Korea slipped into her former honored matre viciousness. On many occasions, she argued vehemently that it was a waste of time to care for anyone who had contracted the plague.
Our resources are better spent on more important things, on activities that have some chance of success.
Mirbella could not dispute her logic, though she did not agree with the opinion.
We're not thinking machines. We are humans, and we will care for humans.
It was a sad irony that as more and more of the population died, fewer reverend mothers were needed to tend the remaining sick. Gradually, those women were able to turn to other crucial activities. From a nearly empty chamber in the keep, Mirbella peered through the broad, arched window segments behind her throne chair. Chapter House had once been a bustling administrative complex, the pulsing heart of the new sisterhood. Before the plague struck,
Mother Commander Mirbella had been in charge of hundreds of defensive measures, monitoring the constant progress of the enemy fleet, dealing with the Ixians, the Guild, refugees and warlords, anyone who could fight on her side. Far away, she could see the brown hills and dying orchards, but what concerned her was the eerie, unnatural silence of the city itself. The dormitories and support buildings, the nearby spaceport field, the markets, gardens, and dwindling herds. All should have been tended by a population of hundreds of thousands. Sadly, most normal activity around the keep and the city had halted. Far too few remained alive to cover even the most basic work. The world itself was virtually vacant, with all hope dashed in a matter of days. So shockingly sudden. The air in the surrounding city was heavy with the stench of death and burning. Black smoke rose from dozens of bonfires. Not funeral pyres, for Mirbella had other ways to dispose of the bodies, but simply the incineration of contaminated garments and other materials, including infected medical supplies. In an admittedly petty moment, Mirbella had summoned two exhausted reverend mothers. Telling them to bring suspensor clamps, she had ordered them to remove the deactivated combat robot from her private chambers. Though the hated machine had not moved in years, she had begun to feel that it was mocking her. "Take this thing away and destroy it. I abhor everything it symbolizes." The obedient women seemed relieved to follow her orders. The Mother Commander issued her next instructions. "Release our melange stockpiles and distribute spice to all survivors." Every healthy woman was dedicated to tending the remaining sick, though it was a hopeless task. The surviving Reverend Mothers were utterly exhausted, having worked without rest for days. Even with the bodily control taught by the Sisterhood, they were hard-pressed to continue. But Melange could help keep them going. Long ago, in the time of the Butlerian Jihad, the palliative properties of Melange had been an effective measure against the horrific machine plagues. This time she didn't expect spice to cure anyone who had already contracted the disease, but at least it would help the surviving Reverend Mothers perform the daunting work required of them. Though Mirbella desperately needed every gram of spice to pay the Guild and the Ixians, her sisters needed it more. If the unified sisterhood died on Chapter House, who would lead the fight for humanity? One more cost among so many. But if we don't spend it now, we will never buy victory. Do it. Distribute whatever is necessary. As her orders were being carried out, she made calculations and realized to her dismay that there weren't enough Reverend Mothers left alive to deplete the Sisterhood's hoarded spice anyway. Her entire support staff had been stripped away, and she felt isolated. Mirbella had already imposed austerity measures, severely cut back services, and eliminated every extraneous activity. Even though most of the Reverend Mothers had survived the plague, it was not certain they would survive the aftermath. She summoned those who were mentats and ordered them to assess the vital work and create an emergency plan of operations, using personnel who were best qualified for the essential tasks. Where could they possibly get the workforce necessary to maintain Chapter House, rebuild, and continue the fight? Maybe they could convince some of the desperate refugees from devastated planets to come here once the last vestiges of plague died out. Mirbella grew tired of simply recovering. Chapter House was only a tiny battlefield on the vast galactic canvas of the climactic war. The greatest threat still remained out there, as the oncoming enemy fleet struck planet after planet, driving refugees like frantic animals before a forest fire. The battle at the end of the universe. Kralizak.
A reverend mother came running up to her with a report. The woman, barely more than a girl, was one of those who had been forced to attempt the agony long before she should have. But she had survived. Her eyes bore a faint bluish tinge now, a color that would grow deeper as she continued to consume mélange. Her gaze had a stunned, haunted look that penetrated to the depths of her soul.
"Your hourly report, Mother Commander.